Hey, everybody, thanks for joining us at Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors this week. Lynda.com, a huge learning resource on the web. It's just the largest one on the web for sure, full of video training and stuff. Go to Lynda, LYNDA.com/shoptalk for a 7-day free trial. And Environments for Humans, who have another online conference coming up. Go to Rosenfeldsummit.com, R-O-S-E-N-F-E-L-D, Rosenfeldsummit.com. It's a one-day online conference about UX. It looks really cool. We'll tell you more about those things later. Let's kick things off.
Shopomaniacs on the light and dark nets. It's good to have you here. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening again. And we have with us this week, Miss Tracy Rotten. How are you, Tracy?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's Taupecat on Twitter, right? T-A-U-P-E-C-A-T.
Yes. Taupe is the color. Cat is the animal.
Yep.
Do you own a taupe cat? Is this the reasoning?
Yes, I do. And she is somewhere under my desk right now at my feet. So
that's good. Mine would be hopping up onto my desk to poop on my mouse hand. That's his MO.
And that's your URL as well.
Yep. That's pretty much everything.
And you live in Maryland.
Yes, I do.
Right? Mm-hmm. Okay. What's up with Maryland? Rockville or North Bethesda?
Yeah, pretty much depending on, you know, if I'm selling my house or not, it's Rockville or North Bethesda, but it's cold here. It's been incredibly cold for incredibly too long. It's kind of ridiculous, actually. Winter won't end. Oh,
I would high-five you about that, but I just commiserate.
Not so me, part it's of the- 70. I'm in a t-shirt and shorts. This is wonderful. How's the scene out in Maryland? Is it the web design scene? I know we get people asking all over, like, hey, what? There's nothing in my neighborhood. How is it out there?
Out here, it's great. We're kind of in the Baltimore, D.C. corridor here, and there's a lot of great stuff that's going on in the web design world, a lot of great agencies, including the one I happen to work for, RP3. And, you know, we have some great WordPress folks here. We've got some great front-end development stuff going on here. It's just a really exciting place to be, and I'm getting a lot out of it.
Nice. So you're a WordPress person, right?
Yes, I am. I really enjoy working with WordPress. It's not exclusively what I do. I do also a lot of front-end development on other platforms, but WordPress has kind of become my major love in building websites these days.
Right on, right on. And you do some of that at RP3? Or so what's, yes, your, well, I mean, what's your position at RP3? What's kind of day-to-day like for you?
Well, I'm a lead developer. RP3 itself is an ad agency that's become kind of a multifaceted offering agency. We realized a while ago that our clients who were coming to us for print work or TV work, et cetera, were also incorporating digital strategy into their overall branding and advertising. So we've built up an in-house digital team, our creative technology department. And it's truly one of the greatest teams that I've ever been, you know, fortunate to be a part of. It's like, nice, a lot of great people doing really awesome things. So we're doing iOS and smartphone development. We're also doing corporate websites. We had a major CQ5 project that launched last year. We're also doing a lot of WordPress stuff increasingly. Clients are actually coming to us for that kind of work. So it's really exciting that we get to do different things for different clients, expand our knowledge and our services, and just kind of provide a lot of value to clients who, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago weren't looking for digital work and just thinking in terms of print and traditional,
right,
advertising.
And you probably weren't offering it either, but since they need it, now you offer it.
Yes. Kind of a, so.
Right. Kind of nice. I like that. You know, like, I don't know, we're sensing a shift to the digital world as the world is feeling, so we might as well change with it. And so, you know, you work on WordPress stuff, but you said developer, you know, I think that kind of works both ways. Is it, you consider yourself more a front end person?
I started off doing front end development because when I started in this some 20 years ago now, that's pretty much all there was. So as you know, I was fortunate enough to get in on the ground floor and kind of learn the new technologies as the new technologies were evolving. It's kind of scary these days to see junior developers come in and having to learn everything at once and pick their niches and all of that. So, you know, I started off just doing HTML and then, you know, eventually CSS came about and kind of learned more about that and JavaScript as well. I was kind of a JavaScript phobe for a while back in the browser war days, but it's really matured into its own strong platform. So, you know, I consider myself a front-end developer first, but, you know, I've also learned enough PHP along the way to kind of do custom plugin and custom theme development, et cetera, for WordPress. So really, I kind of do a little bit of everything along those lines.
That's an interesting sentiment, right? That you got to ride the wave and exactly. Spend your time learning these different things and learn it as you needed to and stuff. And then you see people coming in and they're like, wow, that must be overwhelming. Good luck there. Pat on the back.
Yeah, it is, especially when you're talking about in these days, you've got CSS preprocessors and how you deal with those and learning Grunt versus Gulp versus whatever may be coming up down the line. It's like so many things that even don't even make it to the web page that you have to know just to get to that point. It can kind of be intimidating, I'm sure. So those of us who've been around for a while kind of need to make it, you know, part of our workday to kind of mentor those who are coming in to make sure things don't get too overwhelming.
Right. Yeah. That, I mean, just having somebody around that's there to answer questions, I'm sure, is really cool. Do you have some kind of internship thing that you do there?
Well, we do have, you know, interns in the traditional sense, and we have, you know, junior developers and senior developers, and we do kind of internal training and, you know, kind of sharing of knowledge and technologies and that.
Maybe
kind of
that's the answer to this then, right? It's just to kind of, you know, hire people on that you're okay with them not knowing absolutely everything, and kind of you can use your internal community to get them there.
Right. I mean, you know, as long as people come in with a strong sense of the fundamentals, and, you know, now we're seeing, you know, people apply to positions who have actually taken this in school and who've majored in things like, you know, web development and that kind of thing. And
communication broadcasting.
Yeah. Or creative computing, yeah. I think, was one of the majors one of our developers has. You know, those things were not in existence when I was in school. So, you know, hopefully these schools are teaching them a good solid fundamental and at least giving them the tools they need to continue the learning process.
Yeah. It does sound strong. I like it. Maybe we should knock out a little bit of drama before we get into the Q&A, in which we'll be talking about all these things, WordPress and preprocessors and responsive web design. We'll tackle all that stuff through the Q&A, but let's do a little drama first.
There's this week was pretty heavy. We kind of have a double drama. pretty heavy. So the first one, this could go real quick, but Oculus Rift.
Well, we had Nick Pettit on earlier, and he was all about this thing and talking about VR and how it's going to be this huge thing. And to me, I was like, well, I've never even heard of this thing, but apparently it's big news.
I was about to buy one because he like sold me on it so hard. And then, boom, Zuck comes out of nowhere and swoops up the company for $2 billion.
He sees the same future in this thing. I'm still not over the, like, maybe I need to see some demos to have it click for me, but I'm like, okay, we're all making fun of Google Glass because you have to wear this dumb thing on your head. And this thing is like a giant dumb thing on your head. And I know it's a little different because you're sitting in your living room, right? It's like I'm putting this on in which to play a game or something.
A little more private, yeah. Kind of experiential.
But still, I have my doubts about giant things you need to strap to your head. And anything. Anyway.
It doesn't seem adoptable, but I don't know. Tracy, did you have a gut reaction?
Honestly, I wasn't really familiar with the product until I started seeing all the Facebook acquisition stuff. So, I mean, yeah, on the one hand, you do have the Google Glass and you have this on the other hand. It's just like, what are they trying to accomplish with a purchase like this? Is it some kind of strange convergence that I'm just not grokking right now as to the value in it?
Some guy on Twitter was like, social VR is greater than whatever, gaming or something. And I was just like, really? Like, I guess, you know, the thing about social is like being casual, right? Like, you know, hey, what's going on? You know, it's or like I'm just chilling on my laptop in a room or a coffee shop, you know, like I can't like it seems casual. That's what's social about it. It does. But like putting on a face mask, like to play to like whatever, what message your friends emojis. That seems very, very non-casual. That's what I think the point you're going with, Chris, right? Just how formal and face masky this thing is.
Yeah, and that I can imagine an immersive environment without having to put a thing on your head would be so much cooler, you know? Like, what if there was just stuff flying around all VR style up in your living room? That would be cool. That would feel more natural and fun to me than...
Yeah. Well, okay. Right. So, hey, moving on. Earl Drudge.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, we might as well have a name for it. That's obviously his not his real name. But if you're subscribed to this show in anything, the show right before you'll be listening to this one is that one, which was an unusual show for Shop Talk, but it was about this man who used some social engineering techniques to kind of get into my servers, although nothing really bad came of it because it was caught so fast. He was able to, you know, if things would have gone, if the timeline happened a little differently, he would have had full control over my servers, which is obviously a bad thing. And then some stuff went down and you probably listened to the show. In fact, I almost bet that most people listening to this have, because it was a very popular show. We were a little nervous about putting it on. I had a lot of conversations about it because, you know, this guy literally is kind of a bad guy. Did some literally bad stuff to me. But he agreed to be on the show. So there's a little bit of drama behind it. Not all that much, actually. I did not get too many people that were all that mad at me for having published it. So that's nice. Yep. And there were some people who literally told me, hey, I got LifeLock. It's activated now. Hey, I turned on two-factor auth on a bunch of stuff of mine. And, you know, those are all good security things. So some good came of this thing. So I don't think it was really that dramatic, other than the drama literally between me and him.
There was one commenter on the post, Robert New. He says, great show, Chris. I almost never listen, which is like a nice compliment. And I was totally glued to this episode. Personally, I'd love to hear more of this type of stuff in the future. So he would like you to be hacked on a weekly basis.
No, I'm sure that's not what he means, but
yeah, I listened to that interview and that was really intense. And it was, I know it's, on the one hand, it's kind of feeding the trolls, but on the other hand, it's very valuable information to just kind of put out there to see what people can do and are capable of. And what really struck me about it was how nonchalant he was about some of the things. I was like, yeah, I go into Bitcoin sites to steal money and I deal drugs, like actual solid buy this and consume them drugs. And it just didn't seem to faze him. And the fact that he was going to college for security issues, now you got to wonder, is he meaning to turn his life around, or is he just trying to learn the tricks that the good guys might use to catch the bad guys like him? So it was really a valuable show.
Good. Yeah, I went through like all whatever five stages of grief, I think, just throughout the whole episode, just like how... Is I got angry. I was like, how does the university allow him without ethics? But all in all, like, it was an amazing episode. I listened to it about 100 times while we were kind of editing it down. It was amazing. It was really good. Anyhow.
There was a little bit of drama about it started with Mr. Mark Bolton about kind of how does responsive web design look like responsive web design? And there's kind of, you know, I think people can kind of know what that feels like. Maybe it looks like flat design a little bit, or it's generally less complicated, or I don't know. A lot of us, I think, when we open up a new tab and go to a website that we've never seen before we even resize the browser window, you can kind of guess if it's going to be responsive or not. And isn't that weird that we can?
Yeah, a little bit. I find this whole RWD sameness gate to be a little, I don't know, hoity-toity. Can I go ahead and go on record saying it's hoity-toity? I don't know. Tracy?
Well, I think the point of his post was, I mean, I've seen a lot of posts about should designers learn how to develop, and this is kind of flipping it around. Are developers learning how to design, and is that why everything is kind of looking the same? And I don't think it's entirely true that every responsive site looks like every other responsive site. I certainly hope that that's not true for the responsive sites that I've worked on. But yeah, there is going to be some kind of having to blend the different skill sets between developers and designers. But I don't think it's necessarily true that in order to be a really good front-end developer, one has to be, you know, a designer as well, or the reverse is true. And as for sites looking the way they do because they're being driven by front-end developers as opposed to designers, yeah. I think that's... That represents a fault in the process that came along in building that particular site, not as an overall indictment of the entire, you know, industry on one side or the other.
I think that's an interesting point right there. The kind of the sentiment being that responsive web design is a series of fairly techy things to learn. There's math. There's all this to pull off responsive web design is a fairly techy thing to do. So the people that are doing it tend to be those techy types, which then the sentiment is, well, that's where their skill set is, not necessarily visual design.
I think as designers and developers, we're all still learning. I mean, this is only something that's been around for 2 or 3 years. In an industry that's only been around for 20 years. So we're not talking like a lot of history over the course of time. Mm-hmm. And as designers get more comfortable with it, you're going to see more variations. And as developers become more comfortable with it, you're going to see new experiments taking place. And yeah, right now, a lot of the responsiveness of the websites that I build, I'm pulling that in from guidelines that designers give me, not necessarily from fully realized responsive concepts. But it's a process, and we're all going to learn it, and things are going to improve. And just, you know, take it slow. Let it work itself out.
I like I think it bothers me that like designers are inherently better than front end dev teams in this, you know, it's like, oh, well, total. So now you're like establishing a hierarchy of like whatever savvy or something or like whatever. That just bothers me. I mean, at what point do people just need a gosh darn website and like in 12 columns is actually really flexible to do that or something? I have opinions, but I should probably save it for a blog. But here's what I will say. In the original tweet, there's a bunch of like follow-up comments. Jen Simmons had a really good comment about, I want us to throw out all our 2001 to 2013 ideas of how a web page should be laid out and start fresh. Layout for the web medium. So I think Jen's onto something as far as like getting down to what a website should look like we have all these like old UX patterns and everything from the, like the late whatever 2000s. It sounds so long ago, but the late 2000s, you know, maybe we need to kind of readdress how things are actually now. So with all these devices, I agree.
Yeah, I think that's very smart. I think her comment is very smart when you consider that the grid systems we use now are, you know, holdover from the print era. It's just, as I said, it just takes time for this technology to evolve and for our thinking to evolve with it. And maybe that will have to mean scrapping some of the old notions that we've been carrying forth through this time. But also the technology has to improve. The things like Flexbox and whether or not we're ever going to see CSS regions and things like that, that also has to catch up in order for us to really kind of take advantage and kind of get rid of some of the old systems.
Well, yeah. And then there's like when you make a website that's, you know, 1, 2, 3, or 4 columns, after 4 columns, it becomes kind of hard to like squeeze things down. Everything starts getting a little more awkward. So it's like, well, that's probably why things look all the same. I don't know. So it's the easy way to get a website done and done without having to like reinvent the wheel every time you lay out a site. Anyway, Shall we?
There's some light drama that Tracy brought up. It's on her site. I'll post the link in it of kind of this just of WordPress and kind of possibly what I might consider an old school opinion that WordPress is just for blogs. You want to back us up on or tell us the story on that one?
Yeah, I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts, including one by Sarah Parmenter called Happy Monday, and she was talking to Colin Devereaux, who has another CMS product out there called Barley, and there's 1,000 different CMS systems, so that's not the
problem. That's one that has this like content editable style. I think that brought up the other day, right? Isn't that one? It's like click on stuff on the front end to edit it.
Yeah, I think it's something like that. I haven't played with it myself, but what actually kind of caught my attention was Sarah's comment that she doesn't feel comfortable using WordPress for anything other than a blog because she considers it a hack. And not just, and very derisively kind of calling it a hack in kind of a bad way. And I think WordPress, I hate to always be the WordPress advocate, but I kind of had to go out on this here. It's grown to be so much more. And there's been so many people who've put so many hours and hard work into building a platform that is truly extensible. You can do so many different things with it. With like just content management system, just generally. Now you're talking about products like AppPressor, which let you build iOS and Android apps with it. It can do so much more than just power a blog. That to kind of dismiss it out of hand like that kind of bothered me, and I just needed to write about it and say that no, this isn't a hack. This is dedicated and hard work by people that I know well, and you can't just dismiss it out of hand like that.
Okay, that's worth talking about a little bit more, I think. So there is this, there's a couple of things to bring up, and that, like, what does WordPress look like when you download it, install it, and do nothing to it, and just have it on your site? You could, I think, in my opinion, you could forgive somebody for thinking that it's pretty blog-like in that regard, that you there's this concept of posts and pages, and largely it's like create new post, type it, publish it, and then it goes to your homepage in a series of block, 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 and those are blog posts essentially, right? So it's, even though you can do a lot more with it, that out-of-the-box feel and look to WordPress is fairly bloggy, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it has that in its core. It's where it started from, but it certainly is by no means where it is now exclusively. I've built a lot of websites using WordPress. Very few of them were actual quote-unquote blog websites. And some
and it's
of them
not a hack either. You don't feel
there.
Like you are stretching WordPress beyond what it's built for.
No, absolutely not. It's what's been built into the system over the years. It's truly more than what it used to be, but that's true of lots of different things. A lot of things start off small, do one thing very well, and then can grow their capabilities over time. And WordPress is just one of those things that's done that very well.
Yeah, I agree in that I think of WordPress as different as a just I don't think of it as that way at all. I think it's mostly like this set of ways that it does, like largely I think of it as like a login system. It's like a free way to get a really easy login system, and then whatever else you do inside of that is kind of up to you. I have a screencast called The Right CMS is a Customized One, and it's about how I feel like whatever kind of CMS I use is WordPress in the example, because that's what I know the best way too, is that don't just take for granted that posts and page structure that you have with WordPress. These days, it's very easy to instead of just taking what WordPress gives you, like there, think about what would I make if it wasn't for posts and pages for my site? Would it be a special thing for video screencasts? Would it be a special thing for a movie? And a movie has different information than just a title and posts. It has the title of the movie and the actors in the movie and all that. Think about what kind of fields you need, and then use a couple of plugins that you can chuck into WordPress to give yourself that perfect CMS. And I think that's really like kind of quick and easy to do these days, especially with WordPress, with the plugin Advanced Custom Fields and another one called the Custom Post Type UI. So it's kind of like in 5 minutes you can customize WordPress to be the CMS that matters to you. You got any thoughts on this, Dave?
I kind of understand the argument. Like if you have to code out your own custom word post type, you know, if you're doing that by hand, it does feel like, what's going on? But, you know, those UI plugins that do that for you are really awesome and make it really easy to like add a whole other whatever data model. But actually, this is where I might think it could be called a hack, is that like everything dumps into the WP posts table, right? So in the database, so everything is still like a post. That's where I like, it's not a big deal, but as if you were to scale and like try to make YouTube with WordPress, which you could do, it would eventually, that WP post table would fall over, right? Like,
yeah, the database structure is a bit limited that way, I guess.
That's the only place I see that. But I when there's like platforms like Ghost, right, that their whole like thesis is WordPress is too much of a CMS now, therefore we made a blogging only blog.
Yeah, it's like, irony is ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, right? Like, it's just like, so if Ghost is the anti-WordPress, then WordPress is clearly not a blog anymore.
I think Matt Mullenweg used to go around and like he would have people raise their hands at WordCamp and say, how many of you are using WordPress as a CMS, meaning not exclusively as a blog? And it was always like staggering numbers, like 90%, and you know, like,
oh, I mean, it's like you make pages to make that you fill with metadata, you know, like just crap. You're just like filling it with crap basically, and just to like get that CMS functionality out of it. And yeah, I mean, now it's all native into WordPress. So I understand the argument, and I could argue it, but I think WordPress is a CMS for sure. So, well,
did we do all of them? Yeah. You know what? I'm going to mention.
You brought
one. Yeah. And I know. Yeah. I hate to. I don't know. I feel like this one was worth mentioning because it was like a big thought I had last night. And I was just, my mind was focused on it. And so I just kind of went with it. And it was brought up by a post called Shadow DOM by Stephen Wittens. And you've probably been to the site before because it's like pretty much the world's coolest looking website, ACKO.net.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's the WebGL town.
Yeah, dude, it's just amazing. So Steven is like this just an incredible designer, visual designer, but then knows all the tech behind it as well, and is an eloquent writer, and, you know, he just knows everything. You know, he's five times smarter than me, and I'm not even trying to be, like, obnoxiously modest or anything. He just is. He's one of those people that is just scary smart, you know, where you're just intimidated to even know anything about them, because it's unbelievable what they're able to do. And there's this, the latest post is called Shadow DOM, and it really isn't like, this is what the Shadow DOM is and this is what it can do and bring us. It's a very long post that kind of goes into like a lot of like the what sucks about a lot of different technologies on the web, like, you know, isn't it a joke that we don't have good layout yet, and, you know, look at how fonts are handled, look at how crazy that is, and look, oh cool, now we have SVG in the DOM. Well, the fact that SVG, the rectangles or something in the DOM have all the same DOM crap associated with it that a div does is weird and crazy. Why does a rectangle need a base URL and stuff like that? And it's all these like very good and very well articulated points. And then it's just kind of like, look, everything we have sucks, kind of is the vibe that I got from it. And I was like, I've not directly related to this, but I feel like all these people, it's something I've seen over and over, when really, really smart people are around long enough to get jaded kind of on what we have and where we're going on the web. And I was kind of like, I don't know, I guess I feel differently. I feel like we don't really have much of a choice. Browsers work the way they work. Even if the past sucked, we have to kind of fight with what we have now, because throwing it all away isn't an option. There's no way that we could do that. It's just not going to happen. So I think,
Chris,
yeah,
are you kind of hypothesizing that the greatest publishing platform that has ever existed in time and the biggest,
yeah,
like
the most successful languages ever?
Yeah. And the most used and successful language ever is inadequate?
Well,
is this kind of your hypothesis?
That's another way that you could take it, too, is to be like, look at how well this is done. Despite all the cracks in its foundation, look at how wildly successful it's been. Think of all the money people have made. Think of all the political platforms that have been raised and shut down and people's lives that have been better for it and the world and the knowledge that's been shared on it. Oh, my God, isn't this incredible? Like, I'm not too worried about but that's, you know, I don't want to trivialize what the actual, you know, or make the conversation too wide that it's trivializing the points that were actually being made here. But I don't know. Well, I was trying to be positive about it while being negative about it. It was weird. What do you think?
Well, I love your post about it, the hating on the web tag. And my answer to him is like, go back in time to 1997 and see what it's like to code a website without CSS or with JavaScript working differently on different browsers or whatever. I mean, we've come a long way over time. And this goes back to what I said, you know, introducing myself. These technologies keep evolving and they're not going to be perfect all the time because the human beings that are creating them are not perfect. So if you see something that really sucks, try to do something to make it better. But you know, you just can't say that everything's terrible and everybody's unhappy. No, it's a great platform. It's a great system that has been built up over the years. And if, you know, we just need to work with it and it'll keep getting better.
So I hope so. And then my final sentence was that I don't know that we have much of a choice either. Yeah. Like that's just going to be the way it's going to be, I'm afraid. All right, now we can do some questions. Let me do a sponsor first, though. Let's do lynda.com. That's lynda.com. You've probably heard of them. If you haven't, they're probably the biggest learning resource on a huge variety of topics that there is on the web. That's video training stuff, which is kind of a nice way to learn on the web, right? You can literally watch another human being teach you something right to your face, you know, and you can do it from wherever you want to. It's pretty nice. You can get 7 free days of a lynda.com account giving you access to their entire library of stuff by going to /shoptalk. So lynda.com/shoptalk. It's kind of, I mean, I have a course on there. I did one on WordPress back in the day about theming and how you can kind of think about theming. So it goes all the way from a blank white Photoshop canvas all the way to a finished WordPress theme. So we kind of cover a lot of ground, which is kind of interesting. It's kind of, you know, and then as I've mentioned in the past, they have all this web stuff that we talk about, tons of classes on that, but they have classes on a wide variety of stuff. Some courses that just came out is up and running with Evernote, how you can get much out of that, which I think would be kind of interesting because it's one of those things that a lot of people love that I never kind of quite got into myself. There's a new class, a high level class on Adobe After Effects, making faster rendering and stuff. And then classic stuff like, don't you wish you were, you know, like, what if you were like an Excel master? I know we kind of like laugh at Excel, but it's a very powerful, it's extremely interesting accounting software. I think it would be interesting to level up in something a little outside of our sphere like that. Those are the kind of things on lynda.com. Check them out, lynda.com/shoptalk. Let's do some questions.
All right. First question comes in from Mark Szymanski. Hey, guys and girls. I've been using SAS and Compass a lot lately, and of course, I love it. I'm currently not working in a team environment, but I'm wondering if it would be more difficult if a developer was using the heck out of AdExtend. I mean, I've worked with others on code before, and it usually consists of inspecting in browser, then digging into the HTML, where traditionally you would have access to classes and IDs. Now it's kind of abstracted away. Thoughts?
So the question is, SAS and AdExtend. Maybe we should define that quick.
Okay, SAS is a pre-compiler for CSS. You basically kind of write CSS.
We could probably move past that. What is
okay? And then AdExtend is the ability to basically like slurp up other classes. You say like AdExtend ClearFix would be a good one, and you like slurp up the ClearFix class into your article div, and now your article is totally ClearFix.
Yeah, and the way that it works is by comma separating the selectors. It goes and finds everything that you could say AdExtend dot ClearFix as Dave's example, and then every other thing in your code that has that same line in it, it will go kind of make one big long comma separated selector of all that stuff. So it's kind of like an efficient way to share a class together. Now, wouldn't that be confusing if you're on a team and everybody's using extend all over the place? Because it's weird because it like you can extend something that, you know, it isn't right next to, you know, it's kind of, have you ever run into that, Tracy?
Well, I try not to use extend on classes that get written out, so like that they already exist somewhere and I'm just including them in. I mean, that's, you see all the examples, that's a common use. I try to kind of limit my use of extend to the placeholder classes. So what you mentioned before with the clearfix or image replacement or things like that, things that are very utilitarian and non-semantic, I find that they're good for. A lot of people who are also into like object-oriented CSS or some of those other methodologies will also use them to kind of keep the class situs down in the markup and make things a little more semantic. So I haven't really played too much along those lines, but that's an interesting way of using it too. But the other thing is when I start a project, I will have several files, one of which will be underscore extend, you know, being a partial, you prefix them with the underscore. And so all of my placeholder classes will go into that file so that they can be easily found and referenced later. And I'll do the same for mix-ins and variables. They'll each have their own file in a utility so that it's easy for somebody who's coming onto the team to be able to find exactly what mix-ins and extends.
I love it. That's fantastic advice. So don't just go around extending whatever you feel like. If you're going to extend something, do it with one, a naming convention, like you said, some kind of underscore or something that just says this is meant to be. Or you could use a placeholder, right, which is that number symbol in SAS.
Not the
ID, but the circle/circle, the percentage sign. That says this isn't a real class. It's just meant to be extended. And then, like Tracy suggested, maybe keep them all in one file. Maybe keep them in a special file that says these things are kind of meant to be extended. Is that what you meant?
Yes, exactly. And the only caveat with using extend is, well, there's two. One, if you do it poorly, you can end up with like this hideous looking selector when in your compile CSS with a whole bunch of crap in there, kind of hard to figure out what's actually doing the extending. The other problem is extend doesn't work so well in media queries, and with the new SAS 3.3 that came out a few weeks ago, it even breaks. So you want to make sure that you're using extend, you're using it outside any responsive media queries that you're using.
Right, and there's good reason for that, right? I mean, extend moves in the source order of the code. It moves where that selector is. So if you extend something outside of a media query, it could all of a sudden be affecting code that it shouldn't be affecting.
So. Right. I think the SAS team is working on that problem for a future version, but right now it's not ready for prime time.
Yeah, I think I've seen an example of it where it like goes out and finds what you're trying to extend and then like brings it inside the media query and defines it in there and then extends it inside the media query. I think it's just like mega complicated and also has unexpected. Anyway, that's a weird conversation. We should probably do another question.
All right, moving on. Are you guys ready?
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Adam Donnell writes in, and this comes from the if will X replace Y file. Here we go. My question is around CSS preprocessor situation we found ourselves in. I love that CSS is trying to keep up with variables, calc, tint, and whatnot, but when are we going to consider CSS the compiled language, if you will, and let preprocessors be a permanent solution? Making the browser do the variable calculations replacement seems like a performance situation waiting to happen, whereas doing it in the SAS-less files at deployment makes the browser's life much easier. With everyone trying to make that paint and layout process milliseconds quicker, it seems like this is a bad idea.
That's probably a good variables. Way to stop that one, probably.
Yeah, it starts going into C and IDEs and stuff like that from there. But
the overall thing being, can we start thinking of CSS as the compiled language, like something that we don't author in and let the authoring language be pre-processing? I think once you start using a preprocessor, you already start to think like that a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, I when I go back on a legacy project that isn't like been converted to SAS, and it's always like a dilemma. Do I like go through and deal with the tedium of writing out actual CSS, or do I just, you know, change the extension to SCSS and be done with it and go on with my day? And more, the answer to that is the latter. It's just, you know, easier to work with what you've got and make things into SAS, because the time savings that SAS gives you are so much beneficial that it just makes it easier to go that route. And I really don't code in pure CSS very much anymore.
Yeah, I think that's pretty common sentiment amongst a lot of people that, switch to SAS, right? It makes them even a little annoying. I even did a talk one time called CSS is for Computers with that overall sentiment that we can maybe perhaps start thinking of CSS as this compiled language and who cares what that output is. It matters more what the authoring environment is like. And of course, you know, with the caveat of I don't know. I don't want to be too dogmatic about that. It kind of seems like it wouldn't be a bad idea for students to possibly learn regular CSS, and it wouldn't be it. You know, like you were saying, watch that compiled output for extend. Well, that's important. You know, you've said yourself that that's kind of an important thing to watch for. And if we totally ignored what the output is, we could make mistakes there that would be problematic. So it's not like let's totally ignore CSS, but maybe we're getting there.
Yeah, I mean, you want to learn the fundamentals, I guess, when you're coming into this. And I mean, the SAS is only so much of an abstraction versus regular CSS that you still need to know the fundamentals. So if you're going to like learn the order of inheritance and specificity and all of those things, then you probably want to learn that on pure CSS. But once you get into the nitty gritty of actually working on projects where you need to kind of watch your clock and watch your expenses, then you want to have as many tools as you can to cut down on your time. And that's where a CSS preprocessor is really going to pay off dividends. Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting sentiment that literally it saves so much time that it's saving money. You know, it's like it's not complicating a project. It's actually making it cheaper, but faster.
So the three things I need from SAS are partial imports, right? Mm-hmm. Like without a separate request. Nesting is a big one. I could actually live without variables, to be honest, but there are mix-ins will get you out of a bind sometimes, like pretty seriously. So, or placeholders. Those are the things I would need, you know. And if CSS got nesting, that would be really awesome, like for modules, but it doesn't solve the like modularization of your files.
You still need some kind of build step to smoosh stuff together.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I could ever let that go, right? That would be tough.
Right. Oh, well. I mean, maybe you could polyfill it with some kind of use the traditional CSS at include way. And so it would kind of, well, whatever. It could read some kind of grunt thingy would read it and do it. Still need a build step, though.
Yeah. 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 Or if you like set the browser at that, it would the server. That's just pre-compiling at runtime.
Quick sponsor. That's that one I told you at the top, Rosenfeld Summit. It's Rosen, R-O-S-E-N, Feld Summit. Rosenfeld is a book publisher, and they have all kinds of excellent books on the subject of web stuff and UX stuff. They're having a UX conference in conjunction with Environments for Humans. So it's a one-day thing. It's April 24th. That's a Thursday. It's coming up pretty quick here. So it's a one-day thing. Pretty inexpensive. It's $179 if you just go yourself, and it's an all-day thing. The kind of the title of it is 32 Awesomely Practical UX Tips. So these are all authors of books, and they're going to share with you about their book and then just give you the rundown down in the most practical best stuff out of it. So it's just like a day of UX takeaways, which probably is just going to be amazing. So it's a one-day thing that Thursday, April 24th. And so you can do that thing where if you pay $479, then your whole office has access or whatever. You can do it in a meeting room. So, pack the room with people and do it that way is pretty cool. Possibly even save money there. So Rosenfeld, really cool book company, partnering up, one day thing. You're going to love it. Rosenfeldsummit.com.
Go.
Read one.
Yeah, you
did the first two, but I know I talk too much in general, but I'll.
I think this third one's kind of Aria Town. Let's do something different here.
You want to skip that
WordPress-y?
One?
WordPressy? Yeah, Scotty D.
Okay, Scotty D. I ventured into Git and version control with some WordPress sites that I work on. But my question is, how do I go about pulling down live changes from the live site? For example, I develop locally, and then I push the changes to the live server, sometimes to a deployment server for testing, or maybe what do you normally call that, a staging server. But then if the client makes changes, updates, like adding, uploading images to a post to the live site, how do I get those changes and keep them tracked so I can pull them down into my local environment and keep it all in sync? I'm already using WPDB Migrate Pro, which you've heard us talk about on the show. I'm sure there's some of you out there that were waiting for us to say that answer. But Scotty's saying he's already using that, but apparently it's not doing the images and stuff.
Well, actually, they came out with an update not that long ago where they will pull down the images. And in fact, they've even updated since where you can now push images. So if you're adding stuff on it to a development site that will need to go live, you can push as well as pull. So that they are really kind of addressing that problem. We exclude the uploads directory when we're committing Git, and we're in fact actually going to move to a system where we're going to exclude all the core files and all the third-party plugins that we are not custom developing ourselves, and try to just pull those in through a command line tool. There's an excellent command line for WordPress called wp-cli.
Is that in an effort to keep the Git repository just like cleaner, just only stuff?
Yeah, because I mean, once you push a site live, if somebody else is updating the plugins or the core files, and actually WordPress will auto update itself for minor security core releases, you don't want to get out of sync. It's just easier to kind of keep two things updated separately using a tool like WPCLI, and then only worry about committing to Git the things that you have total control over, which are your custom plugins and your custom themes.
Okay. I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, keep away the stuff that is like that. Sometimes I've gone that way. I should copy your practice, because I have some sites where the whole root of the whole site is in Git. I have one where I've restrained it to just the WP content folder, so just plugins and themes, really. I have one where it's just the theme folder only. You know, like, I've yet to, like, just figure out exactly how I want Git to do this thing.
Yeah, I just gave you our grand overreaching notion of how we're going to do it. We haven't actually really implemented this yet. This is one of the projects I'm working on
right now.
It seems
so custom. One of the things you could do is just, like, a really elaborate Git ignore file that just ignores.
Yeah, and I think those exist. And I know some of the core WordPress lead developers, like Mark Jaquith, actually have projects, and I can throw it in the chat room, where it does kind of separate out the core stuff from anything that's custom, so that, you know, it's a little more separate and a little easier to just include your custom content work into the Git repository and exclude the stuff that comes from elsewhere. So I'll put that in the chat room.
Cool. It'll be interesting to see how that goes down. Want to do another one?
Yeah, no, I'm just wondering if WordPress will ever get a flat file config. Do you think that's in the future?
That would be awesome.
Well, you can do some things. Like, I mean, WordPress will record like your site URL and your home URL in as options in the database, but you can actually put in the wp-config file those things which will override those, which I found is useful when I'm, you know, working from development to staging to production. But yeah, to have a more of a flat file for all your options, including for your plugins and stuff, that's still kind of a dream that's down the line, but I do know that there are people who are working on that.
Wow, that's cool. Because that seems like the biggest handoff in the, like, database in remote and local environments, keeping them in sync, right? That seems like the big...
How does Rails do it, Dave? On my Rails project, I commonly use, like, if rails.env.development ? And then put stuff in there, and you can kind of use that. It just kind of knows if it's in development or not.
Yeah, so, and Rails or Ruby and Node, they like have these like environment flags, you know, that I think it's like at the system level, like your Ruby level or whatever. And on your machine, it'll be development or not production, basically. And then you have to like explicitly set it to production on your Yeah, on your target server. So if you're using Capistrano or something like that, I think it'll set it up for you.
I bet somebody's tried to do that in WordPress before. At least you could do like if you know URL equals localhost or whatever your local thing is. Then like I'm imagining a WP config file that's okay to push. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually what I did on the last WordPress project. Is kind of had that if then statement looking at the URL and setting some of those bigger variables accordingly. Yeah.
It's, you know, the database thing is a big one, but there's also things like, I don't know, I use Jetpack, and Jetpack, you don't want to connect your local version of Jetpack to WordPress.com, but you can't do crap with Jetpack until you do that. So you have to, now there's like some weird thing in wp-config to like trick it into being in development mode or whatever. Yet another reason why I have to be super careful about not doing that in production, because it'll break everything. All right.
Oh, we don't have enough time on the show to get me started on Jetpack.
Oh, Jetpack, you deviser of humans. All right. Let's see. We got a question from Jason Witt in. I'm a WordPress developer, and I've noticed a disturbing trend lately. More and more clients are wanting developers that are experts with a specific commercial theme. Weird, right? Well, I'm wondering what the best approach to tell them that that's complete nonsense. I'm a WordPress developer. I make WordPress themes for a living. I am a GD professional. No, he didn't say that. I know that those commercial themes are generic by nature. And to me, one commercial theme is no different than any other commercial theme. Thoughts, Tracy? Like, I assume he's talking about something like Genesis.
Yeah,
or that's a popular
that's
one.
That's what comes to my mind, too. I actually don't have a whole lot of experience working with those, things like Genesis either. I usually just take underscores, which is a simple, clean starter theme. It's put out by Automattic, which is the company kind of behind a lot of WordPress development. And I just go from there, and I just do everything custom. I start with a static prototype, and then I build my theme out of that. So I can't really offer too much insight as to what makes things like Genesis and some of the other ones out there so much better. I've talked to people who are Genesis developers, and they swear by it, and it gives extra hooks and filters and such. But it also causes problems, too, that if you're using Genesis as a start theme, and then you buy a Genesis child theme on top of that, well, then you're kind of stuck because you can't have grandchildren theme. So you would either have to customize a theme that you've already purchased or go back to building right off of a clean Genesis. So I'm not really up on that notion either.
That's interesting. But yeah, like you said, Genesis theme developers, which is like I'm giving them a specific job title, right? They swear by it. They love it. They're just like, yeah, no other way to do life. This is the best, right? And then, but it, down the line, it's all WordPress, right? I could see this with like Thesis. Thesis is one of those popular ones, right? Like,
Wasn't there a bunch of drama behind that one at one time?
There was. It was like he wanted to do like MIT, but then he had to be GPL licensed or whatever.
Jason Witt was saying it's not even a theme framework, but even just a specific theme. It could even be more specific than a framework.
So like they want you like whatever the
yeah.
Hemingway theme, the commercial theme, Hemingway.
Yeah, like I'm only hiring someone who's very familiar with that. That would be really weird.
Yeah, I don't know, man. That's tough.
So it's like clients like knowing a little bit enough that they're dangerous, kind of whatever that old saying is.
Yeah, I would probably BS my way through this and just put a bunch of keywords on my site.
I did have this debate with an expression engine developer once, and it was his notion, too, that you kind of had to start with something like Genesis. And I'm like, no, you can start with just – you can start from scratch if you wanted to, or you can start with something like underscores. But Genesis has built a reputation around it that's what people think of. So I'm pretty sure that that's what this questioner is asking about as well.
Well, okay. I hope we answered
like the
your
BS
question,
advice.
Jason.
That was good,
right? Just like they don't. I mean, they probably know, but like they don't. If you can do anything, just put it on there if people are asking for it. But then maybe he doesn't want to like go buy the commercial theme to work on it. I could see that too.
Anyway. Let's do Josh White. This may have been asked before, but I've yet to make the leap from SaaS or less to it. Does it become troublesome and inconvenient to work with people and projects that don't use these new methods? I've heard about how someone can accidentally modify the CSS directly instead of compiling it, and it kind of hoses things up. Is there anything I can do when I finally get with it to keep that from happening, or do you pretty much just have to deal with it?
Now, is he talking about other developers on a team, or is he talking about what a client might do?
I mean,
after
you mentioned
delivery?
Just earlier that like you're like, oh, I'm going to jump into a project that hasn't been converted yet, and you're like, well, maybe I'll just. You said I'll do the latter, which was just make the file extension SCSS and roll with it. When you do that at your job, are you worried that you're annoying somebody else who might also have to touch that project, or is there an agreement at your office that that's just the way it is, or do you kind of work alone on stuff like that?
In our office, we're going SaaS to all of our projects. So if they're a legacy project that we're just revisiting now, then it's getting moved to SaaS, and we're all on the same team. But, you know, in my freelancing days, in my contracting days, when I was going from project to project, oftentimes I was the one who was like all ready to jump on the CSS preprocessor bandwagon, but the contracting person I was working for wasn't. So that was kind of a little bit of a disconnect. I would say if you're going to bring on team members or you're going to join a team, then you pretty much just need to have the ground rules set. Like, are we coding in vanilla CSS or are we going with the CSS preprocessor? And if so, which one? SAS. And just, you know, make that established in the requirements. As far as like the other possibilities, like if you're handing this off to a client who may then muck around with compiled CSS, the way I would handle that is to have like a client.css file that gets loaded in last and say, if you want to make updates, you make it to this file. Because otherwise, they're not going to be able to wade through minified CSS, and you are minifying your CSS, right? So, you know, just have that there so that when you go back to the project after a while, because the client wants the phase two or whatever, then you can take what they've done in the client.css file and make those modifications in your SAS files and bring everything up to speed.
Yeah, that sounds very reasonable to me.
That's great. Yeah.
Sounds like a little bit like the junk CSS idea. You might even do that to yourself if you're like, I'm just going to write some CSS quick and then kind of deal with it structurally later. But even better than that, really, because it's kind of like, you just do your thing over here and I'll deal with it later.
Yes. Yeah, it's a shame.css file. Oh, right. More likely, in my case, the shame.js file. Where I do things like that.
That's better. Shame. I like shame.js. That's great. I should
shame.js to do causes extreme memory leak. That's how my JS works. I really like that idea. I guess what do we need to like then break up with the like do we need to educate our clients that you need to break up with the whatever the commando CSSer in mentality? How, I guess, do we need to teach that, or is it kind of like, hey, it's theirs, they should figure it out, or they can do whatever? And that's the tough question, right?
Yeah, and I don't think there's a global answer. I mean, I would really like to say that, yeah, we need to teach them out of it. I mean, you know, you've in other professions, you wouldn't like, or other aspects of, you know, advertising, let's say, you wouldn't go and rewrite the copy of a radio ad after it's been sent to the station for airplay if you were the client. So why would you think that you really should be able to do that with the CSS? And especially if you don't really kind of have a full understanding of what a small change might do globally, it can get very dangerous to muck with the CSS. You can do a lot of damage and not really realize it. So while I would hope that clients would come back to us for updates and changes like that, the reality is they might not always have that consideration. So
I like that radio analogy in like somebody, another creative department, somebody can't just like go into the Coca-Cola commercial and be like, you know, I think the Coke bottle should be purple this time. And like, so he starts like messing with After Effects or something, you know, that's like extreme, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So why does it happen in our industry? Womp womp. I'll do a sad trombone for that. But on that note, on that bombshell, Tracy, thank you so much for coming on the Shop Talk show. We really appreciate it. But before you go, how can people follow you on Twitter, give you money? And then what's the one big thing you'd like to kind of plug?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Taupecat, T-A-U-P-E-C-A-T. To give me money, I'm actually trying to finish writing a book about responsive WordPress theming. So if you are curious about that, it's not finished, but I have kind of put it out there for people to kind of get their hands on early. And that's at responsivewptheming.com. And my big thing is I am happy to be talking about responsive web design and WordPress at WordCamp Miami on May 10th. So I hope to look for people there.
Sweet. So if you are down in Miami, go there.
Yep.
WordCamp. Awesome. Well, thank you everyone for listening. We really appreciate it. Chat room, you guys are stellar. You guys are the real winners today. And we really, be sure to, I guess, buy stuff from the store while we still have it here. And then follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. And Chris, do you have anything else?
ShopTalkShow.com.
We did it. Thanks, everybody. I'm going to take us off air. You guys are great. Bye.